And we have to move on to our next show today, which is our public affairs show in at WHFR.FM, the station making waves. It is 1 o'clock and time for the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Happy to be with you. It's our first official show of 2010, and looking forward to a fantastic year, and I know all of us would like to see something better than last year or the year before, at least economically speaking in this area. Always get our hopes up at this time and making our resolutions. And so WHFR Journal is going to keep on top of things and trying to give you some new ideas about directions to take. And we always have, of course, a number of special guests that we can provide to you. And today is no exception to that rule. I should say that my co-host today is Dennis Reimars, who's in the studio with us. Hi, Dennis. Welcome back.
Hi, Jay. Good to see you.
Always good to see you, too. Amy Powers, our WHR News Director, needs to take the day off today because she has a full-time job. Oh, boy.
I'm glad one of us does.
Yeah. She wasn't sure about that. You know, Dennis, some sort of twists and turns the last couple of weeks. She thought she was going to report for her first day a couple of weeks ago, and they said, let's just hold back a little bit. And she's like, oh, they're going to back out of the offer, you know. But she was negotiating her hours yesterday.
It was
her first day at work. So she is gainfully employed. Who said that WHFR can't lead to full-time employment, right?
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out what her hours are, probably midnights to 4 a.m. or something. But she's with CBS Radio now doing part of their web team. Good luck to her, but we hope to have her back. We hope that she can schedule her time so she can be actually talking on the air with us on Fridays.
Well, from what I understand, that was part of her. She said that she had to have between 1 and 2 off on Fridays.
Right.
Okay, I made that up.
Mm. And Dennis is on our staff, of course, as well as being the editor of the Mirror newspaper here at Henry Ford Community College, and Campus Connection, hosted by Dennis and Lindsay. We hope we'll have our second edition of that next week.
They'll come out on Tuesday, yes, between 1 and 2.
Between 1 and 2. And if you can't catch up on what's happening here at the college that impacts directly to the community, they always do a sort of a community-oriented version of Henry Ford Community College information. You can get that online, just like for this show. Go to our website, whfr.fm, and in their case, click on the forum button for the date of next Tuesday, which will be the 11th.
That's right.
Yeah. And so you can listen to it after 2 p.m. next Monday and next Tuesday if you can't catch it live. In our studio, we have a special guest, and what a wonderful community activist and an employee for the city of Dearborn for a period of time, too, directly, Imogene Woodyard. We welcome you to the Journal, Imogene. I know you're very humble, but tell us a little bit about your background with the city and the Community Arts Council and even, again, maybe very briefly, the creation of the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. You were very, very instrumental in that development, and especially, of course, its facilities for the arts. So, brief bio?
Oh, be happy to do that. It seems like I've been around forever, Jay. But first, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. It's been a while. I've been around for a while. Got started back in, I think it was 1985, when I started as a volunteer with the Dearborn Community Arts Council.
And that's the same year WHFR began broadcasting on the air.
And you know what, Jay? I remember you coming to an Arts Council meeting talking about WHFR. So we go back together in this world. And it was with the executive director, finally became the executive director of the Arts Council. and stayed in that position for about 12 years. We morphed into the old City Gallery on the fourth floor of City Hall, if people remember that, and then eventually moved over to the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center in 2000, actually before it was officially opened. It opened in 2001. It was at that juncture that I, as I say, switched sides of the desk. I began working directly for the city as a city employee through the Recreation Department. I was the Cultural Arts Coordinator and worked on all kinds of great programs, including all the fine arts programs that emanate from the center. But I also worked on Homecoming, another chance for us to work together.
Yep. Don, always a big part of WHFR's years to be out there meeting our listeners directly.
Absolutely. We always loved working with you guys. And I left that position in 06, early in 06, and became the executive director for the Downriver Council for the Arts, which is a regional arts council. So it serves 19 Downriver communities. So,
wow, I didn't know of that.
Yeah, it gave me a chance to see the regional scene.
Sure.
And it was very, very rewarding. But I had the opportunity about 2 years ago to come back and become the executive director for the Dearborn Community Fund, which is my current position. And I thought it was a great opportunity because the Community Fund's mission is to provide volunteer and financial resources for cultural, recreational activities, projects, programs that affect the citizens of Dearborn. And the Community Fund is in the process of building itself. And so I saw it as a real challenge. And
How did it get started?
The Community Fund was actually started in the year 2000, whenever the construction for the center was going on. And it was a way for, it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Okay. So it was a way to do a capital campaign to offset the cost of the building, to solicit donations that would go into the, you know, the construction of the building. But all along, the mission was broader than just that building. The building was just one project, and that's done.
Okay.
The long-term mission is, as I explained, to provide other resources, we'll say, for cultural and recreational projects and programs.
So it was actually sort of like the city of Dearborn decided to set up this foundation.
The mayor at the time was Mayor Michael Guido, and he and the planning committee looked into the possibility, and they got the ball rolling and set it up in the year 2000. So it's been around for a while, and I will say this, that part of my job has been to change the perception of what the Community Fund is about. In the early days, it was about the center. And helping with that. But that's done. That has been done for a number of years. So now we're looking at programs that impact the greater community as well as provide opportunities to bring people into the center, in particularly students and youth groups and schools. And so we spend a lot of time working on projects that carry out that.
Such as, you've got one that is currently the main focus for you. You were telling me about 2 weeks ago.
Absolutely, it is a major initiative. It's called Pockets of Perception. We are one community, or we call it the POP Project. It was actually launched in October of this year, and the concept is that a student team selected from our Dearborn schools, and by the way, the applications were solicited from public, private, charter schools. The word went out.
Okay, to all of them equally?
To all of them equally. And it was to put together a student design team of between 12 and 15 students. They're juniors in high school. We selected the junior level because part of the goal of this project is to encourage multicultural understanding among the students and to have them work together, sharing, you know, their history, their heritage, whatever, to create public art. So it's more than just an artsy feel-good project. It's also a project designed to bring, you know, common understanding, starting with our young people. These are the future. You know, where we want them to invest in the community, to feel proud of the community. Excuse me. And so a call for applications went out, and we have a planning committee that selected, in the end, 16 students. And we didn't get a good response from the public, or I'm sorry, from the private / charter schools. But the public schools, of course, stepped right up. So we have a team of 16 year olds. We made it 16 because we had, it was difficult to choose. They had to fill out quite an extensive application form. They had to write a short essay. They had to have letters of reference. They had to submit examples of their work. If they were a visual artist, an image. If they were a musician, a CD. If they are a writer, a piece of writing. And they did not have to be art students per se. Okay. Rather, students who had creative thinking outside the box kind of thinking, and we thought would be a good fit. We have a terrific team. As I said, we launched this in October, and the students had to sign a contract.
Wow.
Because this project runs through June of 11.
Mm-hmm.
They had to sign a contract. Their parents had to sign it with them. And we're approaching it as a work opportunity for them, so that they were expected to meet certain attendance requirements, et cetera, et cetera. And if they successfully complete and honor the application or the contract, they will receive a stipend at the end of it.
Oh, money.
As a thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, yes. Okay. But what we're finding is that they're so involved in this project. Attendance is one prerequisite that's very important, and
sure,
they're not
sure.
missing. They're not, okay. And we thought, oh, we'll lose one or two of them.
Weekly meetings?
Yeah, weekly meetings. It's after school on Saturday, so they have to give up Saturdays for this.
Morning, afternoon?
Basically from 10 to 2.
Okay.
10 to 2, so they have to make a major commitment.
Before the party time later on.
Exactly. And they are to learn, part of it is to deal with the multicultural understanding. Part of it is to come up with a design concept of public art.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, we have an advisory committee that's made up of people who have, that are connected, for example, to the city proper.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're going to design a piece of public art? Well, where's it going to go? What's it going to be made of? What are the safety issues? What are the permitting issues?
That's a separate city committee.
Right, right.
Okay.
And so the
commission
students,
or whatever.
Right. The students are learning all the intricacies of designing public art, all the way from creating the concept to actually putting it together, to what's it going to take to install it where we want to install it. So mm-hmm. they're going to have to go before city council. They're going to, so this is a multi-level learning experience for these students.
I have to mention a negative point about some public art that I've noticed in West Dearborn, of course, where there are some open spaces, some vacant lots, since all the development that was proposed maybe a decade ago hasn't happened yet. And we have some stories about that later in the hour that we're going to get to. But I'm sorry to say I've gotten some feedback from friends and relatives. Certain pieces of public art, sculpture that's out there, the general impression of just my very limited and maybe somewhat strange circle of friends is that it's a bunch of rusting derelict metal. They can't see why it's sitting there. It seems to be a negative, not a positive. Of course, the space is there, and I know several of the Dearborn artists that contributed that worked a long time to make some of those pieces. It's not being well appreciated. And this is a real challenge with public art that apparently you're doing a lot of educating and background on. And again, you have to understand the community. You have to understand the businesses nearby and the residential sides. And so that's where that multicultural aspect comes in. A very, very valuable thing. So I'm not trying to be negative with all of the works. There's just one in particular
I know which one you're talking about, and I can address that.
Oh, well, if you want to. I'm just saying is that it's so valuable to understand the difficulty of public art. Just as an aside here, I travel a couple times a year to film festivals in Austin, Texas. I've got a Texas story for later to talk about, too, because it impacts on the situation in the state of Michigan, too. But And that is, Austin, Texas is known sort of as the live music performing capital of the United States, that there's more live bands, mostly rock and rollers, but more live music every night, every week going on in Austin than any other place, and they have all the venues for that. Well, they decided a couple of years ago to give grants to artists that would sculpt larger-than-life-size musical instruments in very colorful interpretations of it, and that would be put on display about every street corner or so. Now, most of them are very fancy, like 6-foot-tall guitars, but there's many other kinds of instruments, and they're all, some are more surreal and some are more traditional and beautiful, but it really fits with the overall theme of the city and the downtown. I mean, people go there, tourists, to take pictures next to these works of art. It's that famous, and they do rotate, and they give new art a chance in these different locations. They're all sort of mounted on a single bit of steel into the ground, you know, above the ground a little bit. But it's really worked out well for them because they had that concept. So it's a lot of design planning and understanding what the community needs, not just at present, but where it's going in the future. So I think that process is great to have young people involved in that. It's not ivory tower education, certainly, and artists have to understand that too, of course, not just if they want some commercial reward eventually, but even just community recognition that can take them on with their careers. It's a very valuable lesson you're teaching. What's your story about the public art?
The other one
we're not trying to be negative about what's there already.
Jay, it's a very valid, and I'm dealing, you know, through my office, I'm dealing with this whole thing. And one of the things that you understand when it comes to art, you know, there are people, as a matter of fact, I just came from a meeting where we had this very discussion, that in a lot of people's minds, art is the sunset, it's the flowers, it's the landscapes, it's the, you know, and so when you introduce abstract anything, it's like, oh my goodness, what are you doing? And my response always is, you know, one of the things that art is supposed to do is challenge you. It's supposed to make you ask questions, you know, look for answers, and in the end, you may still hate it, whatever the piece is, but you know, but when it comes to the piece that I think you're referring to in the sculpture exhibit for this year, this is the Midwest Sculpture Initiative, that this is the second year for it.
I see.
Community Fund has provided some financial support and leadership for it, as has the West Dearborn Downtown Development Authority and the East Dearborn Downtown Development Authority.
Okay.
But the one piece in particular, it calls a problem of siting. That's basically what. The other thing is, especially in the West Dearborn area, if that's the piece we're talking about.
Yes, it is, yes.
There's no foot traffic, basically. Yeah. And if one takes the time to really stop and look at the piece, it is very intricate. It is very interesting. You can actually go inside of it. It's a piece called The Ark.
Okay.
And
Driving by quickly from the road.
But driving by quickly, I agree with you. So one of the things that we have learned, even though we had people on the selection committee, I don't make the selections. Mm. There's a selection committee with representation from both downtown authorities. It also calls into question the issue of siting and placement.
Sure.
And again, when it comes to the all the art pieces, sculptors basically today – in this economy and the art world today, work in abstract style. They're not many figurative. We are very fortunate, however, this year we have one absolutely drop-dead gorgeous figurative piece at the west entrance to the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. It's called The Dancer. It's a bronze.
Yes, sure.
And it's kinetic, by the way. The wind
moves
it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of freaks people out. They think they're seeing things. Yeah. But anyway, so we were very fortunate to get that one piece that's figurative. So, you know, we're dealing with a lot of issues here.
Right.
But valid.
I mean, public art, when you meant in location and so on, if people don't expect it to be something artistic, they think maybe it's worthless or it's an ad or it's derelict or something. In other words, unfortunately, for those that maybe are not somewhat studied in the traditional arts and the modern arts, if it's not in a museum, they're not going to give it much attention, and if it looks a little bit unusual, like abstract art generally does, not connected directly with the real-world experience, it's going to be not easily accepted. So there's that problem, but that's nonetheless, the various art forms have a lot to individually contribute if people can give it time, and so that the whole question of location, which is important for
location,
businesses.
Location, location, location.
Yeah, with the arts, too, as well as concept and color and texture and all that. It really is extremely important, more so than what the artist would normally consider.
Exactly.
So, again, I think the sort of big picture of this arts project is very worthy, and of course, giving our young artists in the schools a chance to develop and grow and get some recognition even before they graduate. I think it's very, very valuable.
Well,
Dennis?
I just had a question. How many total applicants did you have? I know you picked 16 out of how many?
This year, because it was the first year, we had 25
okay.
applications.
Well, we know
and
that'll grow.
Now, some came in too late.
Right.
And we didn't even consider those. But, you know, the word is out. The word is out about this project. It's meant to continue into the next year with a new design team place.
Nothing breeds interest like existing stuff. So when people go out and they do see what's out there, what these 16 young people created, I think that's going to, I mean, it won't be long before you're inundated, I think, with applications, and that'll make it interesting.
Well, I think the kids are going back to school and talking about this really great experience that they're mm-hmm. having. We have two professional they're co-directors, and they're from our Dearborn system. One is Wendy Sample, who was the art resource teacher for Dearborn Schools until she retired.
Mm.
The other
retired,
is
yeah.
Muhammad Bazi, who is a teacher in the system. He's mm-hmm. at the Michael Berry Center now.
Okay.
And they meet every week with the kids. And I should mention, too, that one of the things that we did was approach one of the businesses on Michigan Avenue to see if we could use some empty space in one of their buildings where the student design team, from which the student design team could work. And the Nichols ski and snowboard family stepped forward and said, we have space in our building, come on in. And mm-hmm. so it brings people into their stores. You know, this in the long term, you know, what we're hoping is this generates interest, this generates enthusiasm, this is a little bit of an economic push, you know, at least in this case for them. And it seems to be working. I know they're very, very thrilled to have it there. The design team works basically on Saturdays from 10 to 2, although sometimes they go out on field trips, so they may not be there. But the public is certainly invited to stop in and watch what they're doing, ask questions, see where the project is, you know, where it is at that time. We encourage that. And the Nichols welcome that as well because it takes people through their stores. And, you know, it's a win-win, we hope. Just one other comment I would like to make, though, Jay, if I could.
Sure.
On the sculpture initiative, that is the public sculptures that are out.
Yeah.
It's a year-long project. They're on loan.
Mm-hmm.
So the current ones will go away unless they're sold or somebody purchases them. Would love to have someone buy that dancer, by the way.
Oh, that's
the bronze
for sale,
dancer.
Too?
They're all for sale.
Oh, my goodness.
And we
yeah,
just hate so to lose that, but it is a bronze, and it's very expensive.
Uh-huh.
But having said that, in addition to just having the sculptures, we create other programs from the fact that the sculptures are here. So, for example, last year with the sculpture initiative, we had over 300 school children. They were all fifth graders and high school art clubs that came into the center for writing and creative production workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Went over very well. So we will be doing the same thing again this year. This year we're focusing on middle schools, and we expect to have over 300 students come in again for these workshops. So you talk about exciting. The kids, the young ones, are really the ones that get excited about the sculptures. Their imaginations, just it's great because the instructor for the writing part of the workshops takes them out and tours them and also shows images of them and has them talk about what is it that you see, what, you know, use your imagination. It's incredible what these kids come up with. And so this is all part of...
How can people get more information and for example, young people in Dearborn schools, they might hear about it through their art teacher or other ways from their counselors, I don't know, in the schools. Is this the Dearborn Community Fund? We've been talking to Emma Jean Woodyard as our first guest today in 2011. She's executive director of the Dearborn Community Fund. Is there... a sort of a link or a part of the cityofdearborn.org website?
No, we're actually part of the DearbornFortCenter.com website.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
It's DearbornFortCenter.com/community fund.
That's pretty long.
Yeah, it is long. But if you get on the Dearborn Ford Center site, there's a link right there.
Okay, DearbornFortCenter.com.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then there's a link to the Dearborn.
It's to community fund.
Community fund.
Community fund.
Okay.
That's
correct. And there's information there about this current, which is it your only project or some other projects under consideration too?
Well, the sculpture initiative is a big one.
That's ongoing.
That's ongoing for a year. The POP project, again, the plan is to carry it forward because ultimately what we would like to see happen with the POP project is that it provides summer employment for young people.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
kind of the goal
right.
to which we're heading.
Sure.
There's a very successful program out of Chicago that we're kind of sort of imitating just a little bit.
Okay.
with
well, that's
our
fine.
Own tweet.
Anything that works, that's
yeah.
right.
That's
borrow
right.
it, steal
imitation
it.
Imitation is what the sincerest form of flattery.
That's right.
Well, I would just finally like to say, number one, thank you very much for all your years of service to the community and to WHFR-FM, Imogene Woodyard. We wish the POP Project and the Dearborn Community Fund well in this very difficult time where you know there's going to be cuts in education. There shouldn't be, but it's going to be a very difficult time to maintain what some people think are the extras, like art and music. And, of course, you and I know that these are essentials. These are life essentials for any sort of decent standard of living and fostering creativity and original thinking from all of us. And we're going to need that sort of attitude much more in the future. So thank you for getting involved again with this group. And we know you're going to be successful. And the POP Project, we look forward to seeing those. When are we first going to see some of the young artists work? Out in public, you think later the summer?
Our goal is early summer.
Great.
Our goal is early summer, so keep your fingers crossed. They're moving right ahead on schedule.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, Jay, you'll love this. They have been doing a lot of thinking and planning and what have you, and they finally said to Mr. Bozzi, the director, "You need to rein us in. We have too much creativity."
That's a good problem to have, isn't
he
it?
He said he Absolutely. Thought it was great that they realized that.
Well, thanks for being with us
here
on the new journal today, Imogene Woodyard, and we look forward to more reports about when those great new works and projects are going to happen in our community. Going to go now to some non-commercial messages and Jim Hightower's comments for the day.
The 2011 winter semester here at Henry Ford Community College begins Monday, January 10th. Open enrollment has begun and can be done on campus or online at hfcc.edu. That's open enrollment for HFCC's 2011 winter semester. Sign up today on campus or online at hfcc.edu. You are listening to WHFR.FM's Best of 2010 Week. Be sure to check out your favorite shows all this week to hear our annual Year in Review.
The teabag-infused Republican takeover of the U.S. House has produced one big change that is already distressing GOP leaders, dismaying the Tea Party's corporate funders, and discombobulating the elite bankers at the Federal Reserve. The change is this. Ron Paul. This 75-year-old ultra-libertarian from Texas has been in Congress for some 35 years, building a consistent record of contrarian views and votes, some of which are quite progressive. He's been a vigorous opponent of U.S. military adventurism around the globe, for example. This has infuriated many in his own party, who have long dismissed him as an extremist nut. But now, Paul has gone from an irritating pest to holding real power. He's the new chairman of the subcommittee that oversees the Fed, America's central bank. He views this secretive, autocratic financial agency as a tool of the Wall Street giants, and he's even written a book titled End the Fed. Even before taking over the committee, Paul has caused apoplexy among Fed officials and big bankers by saying that he'll push for a full annual audit of the agency's financial dealings with the global elites. How extremist, huh? Here's an outfit that furtively funnels trillions of dollars to private profiteers around the world, yet its transactions are not audited or open to public scrutiny. It's the system that's kooky, not Paul. and he's about to shine a bright light into the dark temple of the Fed, exposing an institutional collusion with Wall Street that enriches the few at the expense of the common good. This is Jim Hightower saying, an unleashed Ron Paul not only scares the bejesus out of the bankers, but also the GOP political establishment, which is thoroughly marinated in Wall Street money. What fun, huh? To keep up with the twists and turns and to help Paul stand firm, go to ronpaul.org. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org. Headline, AT&T buys 700 copies of Perry Book. It's a story about Rick Perry, the splendidly coiffed Republican governor of Texas. But it's really about how corporations, corporate-funded right-wing organizations, and corporate-backed politicians happily hum kumbaya together. In December, Perry gave another of his rants on how he hates Washington's power elites. Ironically, his speech was in Washington, delivered to an appreciative audience of lobbyists and other Washington power elites. Perry thinks irony is a country near Iran, so he missed the absurdity of it all. AT&T, which sponsored the luncheon where the gov held forth, has beaucoup business before the Texas state government and is a $500,000 donor to Perry's gubernatorial campaigns. They're tight. So tight that the corporation shelled out $13,000 to buy 700 copies of the governor's book, giving them to every attendee. Perry donated his share of the sale to the Texas Public Policy Foundation. What's that? A virulently far-right corporate front that develops much of Governor Perry's agenda and, in turn, backs him. Then there's the American Legislative Exchange Council, the group that invited Perry to do his shtick about the horrors of inside Washington elites. ALEC is richly funded by such extremist laissez-faire corporate barons as the multi-billionaire Koch brothers, who are among the most elite players in Washington. This is Jim Hightower saying, so let's recap. A corporate front group has a meeting in Washington, inviting the ambitious corporate cozy Texas governor to strut his stuff at a lobbyist-infested lunch sponsored by his favor-seeking AT&T pals, who buy a bunch of his books, the proceeds of which go to another corporate front that backs Perry in exchange for him carrying their agenda. You see, everybody's back gets scratched, and it's all done in the guise of fighting power-hungry elites. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
This is the new WHFR Journal for January 7th, 2011. Happy 2011. Guess we can't really say that after the first week, but here we are still the last day of the first week, and we're happy to have you here. You know, Henry Ford Community College, we mentioned the winter semester there and those announcements. Our new classes, the winter semester begins this coming Monday, January 10th. Very, very busy on campus, people enrolling. There's still places in all kinds of classes, but so much excitement here always at the beginning of a new semester, but it starts Monday. So that applies also to our College of Lifelong Learning, which is sort of our adult education branch that offers non-credit experiences, such as the version of our WHFR staff training class. You can either take that same experience, either for academic credit, 1 hour, or for no credit. And if you pass, get enough points there at the end, you will still be able to be part of WHFR volunteers. And that's always necessary for us. But the whole semester begins this coming Monday. Very busy on campus of people getting their schedules together. If you've already been admitted here anytime, you can do this online. HFCC.edu is the website. You can enroll on that website and get your classes set up that way. I bet their computers are going a little slowly, but Dennis, you have your classes in place?
I do. I'm ready. And that's another thing. I know that, you know, we talk about so many things on this show. Lindsay and I are going to go into quite a bit of detail on Tuesday regarding the new semester. There's so many things
new
going
programs.
On. New programs. There's a lot of stuff going on here.
I'm really excited that I think it's later in February, and I didn't get the date yet, but I know they're going to have the Alternative Energy Summit Conference here.
It's going to be here,
which is usually a one-day affair. I don't know how they're doing it this year, and that's going to be later in February. Mm-hmm. Do you know any details about
all
that?
All I heard was going to be 2 days.
2 days.
I did hear
great.
That. Yes.
Great. Yeah, there's so much to talk about. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
The alternative energy program here at the college began a couple of years back, and it's oversubscribed now. I mean, there's waiting lists because it is one of those definitely jobs for the future that we need so much to have those people apply their knowledge and get things changing in our society now to save energy, to reduce cost, and to just move us ahead into the kind of world that it should be. And I know you've been following the Sierra Club Cool Cities Initiative.
Really? Yeah, absolutely.
Doing reports on that.
But, you know, the program, the high-tech stuff you're talking about is the second most in-demand, the second most in-demand programs in our college followed in gaining on health careers.
So, rightly so, yeah.
And you look at the future, and those are the two areas where they're the brightest, I think, other than radio, right?
Well, we always need the electronic media communication skills for now and the future, because that's how we keep in touch these days, whether radio, which is kind of a one-way thing. I know there's some call-in shows, not this one, but you know, but there's value in all of the media, radio, TV, the internet, iBooks and iPhone communications, and we need to understand what kind of communication is best for what medium too, as well as how to be good at each medium communications. So yeah, our telecommunication program here, as we call it academically, is always oversubscribed. All the classes usually close early. I don't know how many openings are still available there, but that's so essential too. And of course, we offer programs in those here. That's what the beauty is of a community college. We can move a little faster and get a little more in-depth than the four-year schools can for new things that are needed. They'll catch up eventually. But
we know. And, you know, in our program here, the staff training you brought up, there's very few, if any, programs like it within the community colleges and the colleges in Michigan where go through a class and all of a sudden, you know, you pass and do everything right and you're on the radio. So, no, we have a lot of great things going on here.
I'm always so excited at the beginning of the semester. Not so much at the end. No, I am when you're finishing up and moving on and starting over again, trying to get it right. But no,
40 years later,
yeah, just always people coming in excited, and we like to make sure they can get what they need. A couple comments from me here and a couple follow-up stories. One is the Jim Hightower commentary about Ron Paul, libertarian, and of course not well liked by the Republican Party, but now he's the head, since he was a ranking Republican, although libertarian more than Republican, and there are significant differences there. Jim Hightower likes Ron Paul for a couple of his stands, a couple aspects of his libertarianism, such as not fighting those foreign wars that have no direct purpose for the defense of our country and wasting trillions of dollars. Libertarians have always been against that, even before there was an Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right.
But Ron Paul also, his last book that I've read, and I've read both of his books, the Ron Paul Revolution book, and also End the Fed, that he believes the Federal Reserve was a bad idea even at the turn of the century, the last century, you know, 1913, whenever it was set up. But now he's on the supervisory committee in the House of Representatives for the Federal Reserve. So, oh boy, they're scared, those Republicans and those people in the Federal Reserve, on what he's going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, very simply, he would like to see, just as a first step, if he can't eliminate it, and that's maybe important to look at, but as his book well documents, I think, and the Fed is the title of it, Ron Paul, the author, you know, what about an auditing the Federal Reserve, an outside independent auditor every year? Great idea for transparency in government, for honesty. Maybe it would have avoided, if we had been doing this regularly, the crisis of 2008, the financial crisis. So I wish him well, and so does Jim Hightower. Very interesting that there's a lot of populism and populist support for a lot of the beliefs of the libertarians. It's too confusing here to point out easily where the Tea Partiers stand, and even the Tea Partiers are very different among themselves in terms of what they support and why. Just want to mention and congratulate his son, Rand Paul, similar name. And I think his first name probably was chosen because Ann Rand, however it's pronounced, often pronounced Rand, but it I think literally it wasn't. She was a libertarian type philosopher, writer, novelist from Rand? 1950 on. Normally pronounced sure. Rand, but in fact, she never pronounced it Rand. Anyway, his son's name is Rand Paul, and was just elected as a senator. Ooh, Ron Paul is only a representative. His son was just elected a new senator from Kentucky, I believe.
Right.
And so we'll see what influence he might have in his first term in office. Very similar beliefs to his dad's, by the way, although he's gotten into trouble by opening his mouth about certain things about civil rights laws. And you know, it's so easy on the media to say something and then be broadcast in a very one-sided way as being a negative force or being wrong or whatever. And I know he never intended that. But so Jim Hightower, as we said, also on the side of Ron Paul in terms of let's be careful about what the Fed might do or the Federal Reserve might do in the future. And also the second commentary by Hightower, which we featured today, talked about Rick Perry and his exploits with his new book and AT&T's support of $500,000 for his last campaign. So you kind of know where that conservative Republican might fall. But, you know, in Michigan, we got tough times facing us, $1.6 billion deficit for next year's budget, and Governor Snyder's got a great challenge and a lot of people unemployed. But guess what? Paul Krugman in today's New York Times, and again, he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, talks about the Texas omen. He said, these are tough times for state governments. Huge deficits loom from California, who's already bankrupt,
right,
to New York, from New Jersey to Texas. And Krugman says, wait, Texas? Wasn't Texas supposed to be thriving even as the rest of America suffered? Didn't its governor, Rick Perry, declare that, quote, we have billions in surplus, quote unquote? Yes, it was, and yes, he did. But reality has now intruded in the form of a deficit expected to run as high as $25 billion. Of course, Texas is a big state with a lot of people, so they're... when they go into a deficit, it's going to be more than Michigan. We have fewer people.
Right.
We have only 1.6 billion. We look pretty well off by comparison. They're going to have to try to find a way in Texas to cut $25 billion out of their budget. And they've already made so many cuts. I have a friend down there who is a public school teacher who gets paid almost nothing. She's almost just out of the poverty level after 6 years of full-time instruction in Austin, Texas. And don't get me started on their state board of ed, which has some pretty weird ideas what their kids should know or not know. Don't get me started on that. But supposedly Texas is the shining example of Republican conservatism in government. And they're in a lot of trouble. You say, well, how did that happen? Was Perry lying to us? No. It turns out here in this article from Krugman, and I'm paraphrasing to save time, is that they have a two-year budget that's just ending now. So when their budget was stated and their wonderful situation was identified and has been mentioned the same for the last 2 years, it was before 2008 crisis.
Mm.
So before everything went belly up nationwide, their budget was fine.
Hubris.
Not so now. Not so now. The reality comes out. The truth is the Texas state government has relied for years on smoke and mirrors, as Michigan did too, of budget tricks to sound like they had great financing. Now, they don't have as many unemployed in Texas,
right,
and certainly not in Austin as Michigan, but it's going to get worse. And because they have a huge increase in the number of people that have moved there. So they got to get jobs for these people. And so now you might say it's time to pay the piper for all of their success and what they had been covering up. And so that's the situation with Rick Perry, the great conservative Republican. It just didn't work out. You weren't able to keep your conservative ideology and tax cuts and health care cuts and education cuts. It didn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. You can't just cut. You have to have some money coming in from somewhere. And even though there's been great growth in Texas, I mean, even Dell Computers, based in Austin, has not had such glory years recently as almost any company would not. And even the even all the high-tech corporate investment in Texas and the oil and all that, just not enough.
So, and wasn't Dallas held up as one of the model cities also?
I mean,
a lot of huge growth.
Right. So just trying to say is that there's always a little more to these situations than what's being promoted on the surface. And now the tide has turned, and we see the situation that Texas, as well as Michigan, and other states are in. Just a cautionary note back to Rick Snyder is that conservative philosophy alone, which Rick Perry, governor of Texas, has been doing for 4 or 5 years. I think he's at least one term of governor down there, if not the second in his second term. I think he just got reelected to a second term, in fact, Rick Perry. It's not going to work. It's not going to work that way. As I've said here on the show, that reality is always more difficult than any single philosophy to solve the individual problems. Sometimes, let local government do it. Sometimes let state government. Sometimes you got to use the federal government, and you switch theologies and philosophies as needed. Okay.
Yeah, but when you have two states like California and Texas, which are, okay, maybe Vegas gets more tourists and maybe Florida, but other than that, you'd be hard-pressed to find two states with more people coming to visit than Texas and California. Wouldn't you think they'd be able to exploit that or capitalize on that, the fact that they have so much outside money coming in and being spent there? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. To me, it seems so logical.
You would think so, but if you're really intense about the conservative philosophy, at least espoused and practiced by Governor Rick Perry, you see that he has not been investing in the right ways for the
future.
There
you go. You just nailed it. Some of those cuts probably should have been made a long time
ago. Even Austin, whose local city government is demanding great, high, ecologically based standards for sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the investment in solar? I mean, I've never seen a city that has more sunshine than Austin.
Right.
Nobody's using solar.
No.
They're expanding into a megapolis of a urban city complex. Huge investment in highways and gas powered cars.
Oh, geez.
I mean, where's the solar panels on the roofs?
Right.
Nowhere. No investment in that. I mean, they've got a great transit system, but it's all gas-powered buses.
Mm-hmm.
So the large-scale government, the state government, has not been looking towards a sustainable future which will turn around those costs, and even health care, and even education. You get smart people, you get healthy people, they can help the whole state
Absolutely.
To turn around.
And then it attracts more, even more smart and healthy people. Yeah. Well, then I don't even know what California's problem is, because they've had these green things going on for 40 years. You know,
very confusing. The problem is very complicated out there. It basically has been, I think, lack of state direction to go in the right direction. They did respond greatly to a lot of public initiatives,
mm-hmm.
ballot proposals,
sure.
which were almost too easy to get on the ballot, which were contradictory, one after the other being passed.
So nothing getting done.
Nothing getting done in a consistent way.
Right.
So at times you do need large government direction
sure.
and incentive to go the right way. And so, a lot of the individual proposals sounded great. And even, in fact, they just passed. I was listening to Sierra Club Radio, which is a half-hour radio broadcast on the internet from sierraclub.org.
Is that podcast?
You know? Yeah, it's a podcast. Wonderful. You can get it through iTunes. Subscribe as I do, and I listen most every week to it, 30 minutes. California Initiatives, they just passed a big one in favor of green energy direction for the whole state. And you said, well, this is going to cost the state a fortune. But in the long run, the voters are right on that one. It's the investment that they should have been making years ago
sure.
to get more jobs and to get less expensive power. And so on. So things change in California, but it's kind of crazy quilt. And it's interesting that Arnold Schwarzenegger did not support the Republican for governor, Meg Whitman, who lost to good old Jerry Brown, populist Democrat, extreme liberal. I mean, Jim Hightower hasn't mentioned him yet, but he is a wild guy and very much a populist. So he may help straighten California out too, which actually, Schwarzenegger took many populist initiatives.
Now, Brown has a history in California anyway.
Yeah, his dad was governor, and he was governor 35 years ago.
Exactly.
So, and then he was mayor of Oakland, the city of Oakland, California, for many years, successfully, populist, power of the people. Yeah, Jerry, left over from the 60s, old-time hippie, you might say. But never married, always living a very austere life, which we may all need to reconsider for the future. So it's be very interesting. He's just taken office in the last week, too, Jerry Brown. It'll be interesting to see where he goes. I'd like to switch back, Dennis, to big news in for Dearborn and Michigan in business today. They've just announced the opening of the newly renovated Wayne, Michigan Ford Motor Company plant. And what are they making there? Well, 10 years ago, they were making Ford Expeditions and Lincoln Navigators.
Biggest
SUV monster boxes you could ever imagine.
That's right. 12 miles to the gallon.
12 miles to the gallon. That was the history of it. Well, now they're going to be making Ford Focus.
0 miles to the gallon.
Which is, the same Ford Focus design they've had in England and Europe for years, which Ford is fine. It's such a great car, too.
Right.
According to World Journalist, I'm not pro-Ford here. I'm just pro-good stuff. And all the versions of it, including announced today, the all-electric Ford Focus that, yes, Mayor O'Reilly, I would have bought if it was available 4 months ago.
That's right.
Instead, I got a diesel
car. He really tried to sell it. He had the hard sell on you, didn't he?
I had my money down on the Nissan Leaf all-electric, which is already selling, but not in Michigan for a long time. So the all-electric Focus will be available later this year. Even though the Leaf will already be available here, not yet, but soon at that time. And all made in wonderful Wayne, Michigan for the whole country, U.S. of A. And how much did it cost Ford to renovate that?
Wow.
Almost over half a billion dollars, $550 million in renovation. It's a 140-acre plant now. And as the New York Times says here in their story just today in the Times, it's a symbol of a very different Detroit, a greener, leaner industry focused on smaller, energy-efficient cars. And the all-electric, the hybrid version, the plug-in hybrid version, and the gasoline-powered Focus, the Ford versions, take your pick, are all going to be made in Wayne. And as people gravitate toward the more sensible, which will be the all-electric when the batteries maybe get better too in the upcoming years, they can easily in that plant switch over because it's all the same body style, which can accommodate any engine or power source that is currently under consideration. So we wish Ford well. Just too bad that story from the Times Herald from August that I still have in my carry with me in a book about how Ford got a special dispensation to not have to pay as much tax everywhere for every one of their plants, including Dearborn. And it's never been covered by the press and guide. No official protest or legal action or reconsideration request by the city of Dearborn or even Wayne.
Right. Well, that's where all the money went.
Yeah. And Wayne, as I said, in their city council meeting in September, were saying, well, we may have to cut police because Ford's not paying as much tax anymore. And they'll have to go into some deal with nearby communities out there. So, and what was one of the big stories of 2010 in the press and guide, as we saw the review 2 weeks ago? Ford Motor Company made a $2.1 billion profit. That's nice. Even with the over $500 million investment in Wayne, Michigan. Yep. And yet, they can't pay all their taxes that they used to pay. Tough. Something wrong there. That's all I can say. Something real wrong. But I can see how Wayne, Michigan City Council would want to go and file legal action to get all that tax money back, even if it was unjustly taken away by Ford by undue influence, let's say, to the Michigan Tax Commission in Lansing. Didn't happen locally. It happened statewide at the top. Okay. That's what happened there. But what do they got? They got a beautiful, new, renovated, over $500 million investment. And so obviously Ford will pay more tax because of that investment, just not as much percentage-wise as they should be, perhaps. Well, wish them well, and hope they can stay in the area. But I wish they'd pay their fair portion of taxes. Be the good citizen that they would like to be thought of. By the way, in 2 weeks from today, I'm going to be down. We're going to be talking here on the 21st, 14 and 7 makes 21, on the 21st of January about the Detroit Auto Show and about automobiles in general. I know Amy is trying to get an automotive writer from the local area. You know, all the big national auto magazines are based in Detroit and Ann Arbor, from Automobile to Road and Track to Car and Driver, all based in Ann Arbor with their headquarters there, and Auto Week, which I think actually has their headquarters, editorial offices right in Detroit.
Right.
Winding Road Magazine, which is an all-digital online automotive magazine based in Ann Arbor, again. So we're hoping to get one of those people after they're going to be real busy next week reporting on the press preview of the auto show. And you'll see a lot on TV about that, too. But I'm going to be going down, I think, on the afternoon of the 18th.
Okay.
Already got my senior discount ticket.
Did you really?
Half price for people 65 or older. All right. I'm so glad I turned 65, at least in regard to the auto show admission. we'll give you an overview on what's happening and some of the new trends, just like the other people. But we hope to get one of these professional automotive journalists in here, too. We'll see who we wind up with. I'm hoping for Natalie Neff.
And any particular reason why Natalie Neff?
She is the road test editor for Auto Week magazine.
Okay.
And Natalie, if you're listening, respond to Amy Power's phone call, which you may get in a few days. No, because they're very aggressive. They have their own video news highlights every day that they send for free to anybody that wants them.
That's cool.
That's interested in automobiles. And Natalie used to be the key host, and now she got the promotion to top head of road testers for Auto Week, and just a very nice style, very intelligent, and as Amy knows too, it's very hard for women, especially as a journalist in the automotive area, always thought to be a guy thing.
In sports, you're right.
And just wrong, just totally wrong. And so she seems like a very nice person, and maybe Natalie or someone else.
Yeah, but you got to admit, the road test would be the most fun job.
Oh, yeah.
Dealing with cars.
Wouldn't we all die to write stories about the new cars every week? Oh, God. I've been a subscriber and a reader of so-called sports car magazine since I was 12. In fact, it's the first magazine I ever subscribed to.
Seriously?
Was a sports car magazine.
That's cool.
Yeah. I think then it was called Sports Car Illustrated. Ooh, pictures. As if that was something radical in those days.
No, but that's a good thing to have with a car. I mean, I want to see. This will be the first year I go down to the auto
show. Oh, you're going to?
Okay. Amy and I are going. It'll be the first year in so I can't remember the last
time. Did you get press credentials for next week?
She did, yes.
Oh, great.
She got them for us.
Because that's a lot of fun. I've done that, too. And both Amy and Dennis then will get the PR side or some of the insider info from the it's almost overpowering all the media, all the stuff they've got in the media packs.
Is it? It's kind of overwhelming? Okay.
Yeah, the huge canvas sack of videotapes and audio, and you don't even have to go see the cars. They did give you all the, you can write your stories from just going to the media room once and
right.
then going to party. But no, I suggest you see the cars too.
Okay.
It's supposed to be a great show, and do recommend everybody in Detroit because it's the source of the new future, both from Wayne, Michigan and elsewhere for our car industry that we kind of already know how to do, right? Apparently, Cobo Arena has been renovated and improved. New entranceway, new exhibits. A lot of money invested by the Cobo Arena folks and the Tri-County Commission that runs it.
Let me ask you something. You've done this many times. How far in advance do they put the prototypes? Is it the cars that you see at the auto show, many of them will not be in production, if they are at all, for what, 3, 4, 5 years in the future, correct?
Yeah, you just never know.
So
if a concept car gets a great response from mm-hmm. the people down there and from the journalists and a lot of press afterwards
right.
in the media, then they might consider, of course, bringing it out earlier.
Which they did. Okay, so when...
A couple of great examples of that was a Dodge Viper sports car.
Right. Well, when would the Volt have been there, or the Leaf, or the Focus?
Well, the Volt concept was there, I think, 2 years ago.
Only two?
Yeah, it was because everybody knew it was coming anyway. Okay. But unfortunately, the actual vote doesn't look as nice. That vote concept was really sleek.
Was it?
Yeah. Okay. It's just the same sort of size, same concept, four-door sedan, but it just had better look. Just like the Ford Mustang concept of about 5 years ago, shown at the auto show for the last version of the Mustang, was so much cooler than what actually came out.
Is that usually the case? It seems
usually
like
the case. Even the Camaro concept, although I think the Camaro concept 4 or 5 years ago, fairly close to what was released,
as
but
was
still not quite as good because of manufacturing necessity, cost, and so on.
Right.
Yeah. No time left. Sorry, folks. In 2011, we will have another show next week. In the Press and Guide and the Times Herald, a couple of interesting developments in West Dearborn, and I do mean developments. Fakuri gets a go-ahead to continue his projects to try to sell some of the property. But Cambridge Realty of Southfield, new name here on the Journal, is a new developer and has bought some of the franchises from, I think, Burton Katzman and from Fakuri.
From Fakuri?
Yeah, to develop. One of Fakuri's buildings, anyway.
And they alluded to...
And so they are going to try to develop now.
That's why he got the extension.
Perhaps, because other things were going on. But he has some tough commitments here, Dennis, too. He's got to clean up some of his properties, some of the storefronts, and spiff them up. Things he promised to do back in June, but never did because he wanted more of an extension. So he's got about a two-month period now.
And quite a bit of money.
45. Yeah, but they are continuing some also incentives that would pass from Fakuri to anybody else that might jump in there. So they're doing it not just for Fakuri and his company and the other guy that's now the front man for him. Sort of changed names, but it's the same company. So the city was tough in their new extension with Fakuri. Not just saying, okay, we get a couple more months again. So I think some of the problems that even Dennis and I were indirectly alluding to and Amy over the last 3 months, the city did some tough looking at that. But now we have a new player, Cambridge Realty of Southfield, and there's question of how Cambridge Realty of Southfield taking over some of the Burton Katzman responsibility, whether or not the Burton Katzman lawsuit will go ahead in the same way or a different way to get back the $20 million estimated that didn't happen under Burton Katzman. So we don't know there. Also very excited, George Durrani was reported by the Dearborn Press and Guide from 2 days ago. He submitted 5 bills already.